Chapter 38. Ah, sweet mystery of life. About the raid. About raising note. About how she died. About how she died in my arms, there in the basement of the Reverend Lionel J.D. Jones, DDS, DD. It was wholly unexpected. Racy seemed so in favor of life, so right for life, that the possibility of her preferring death did not occur to me. I was sufficiently a man of the world, or sufficiently unimaginative, take your choice, to think that a girl that young and pretty and clever would have an entertaining time of it, no matter where fate and politics shoved her next. And as I pointed out to her, nothing worse than deportation was in store for her.
"Nothing worse than that," she said.
"That's all," I said. "I doubt that you'll even have to pay for your passage back."
"You're not sorry to see me go?" she said.
"Certainly I'm sorry," I said. "But there's nothing I can do to keep you with me. Any minute now, people are going to come in here and arrest you. You don't expect me to fight them, do you?"
"You won't fight them?" she said.
"Of course not," I said. "What chance would I have?"
"That matters?" she said.
"You mean," I said, "why don't I die for love? Like a knight in a Howard W. Campbell Jr. play?"
"That's exactly what I mean," she said.
"Why don't we die together, right here and now?" I laughed. "Razy, darling," I said, "you have a full life ahead of you."
"I have a full life behind me," she said. "All in those few sweet hours with you."
"That sounds like a line I might have written as a young man," I said.
"It is a line you wrote as a young man," she said.
"Foolish young man," I said.
"I adore that young man," she said.
"When was it you fell in love with him?" I said. "As a child?"
"As a child, and then as a woman," she said. "When they gave me all the things you'd written, told me to study them, that's when I fell in love as a woman."
"I'm sorry. I can't congratulate you on your literary tastes," I said.
"You no longer believe that love is the only thing to live for," she said.
"No," I said.
"Then tell me what to live for. Anything at all," she said beseechingly. "It doesn't have to be love. Anything at all."
She gestured at objects around the shabby room, dramatizing exquisitely my own sense of the world's being a junk shop.
"I live for that chair, that picture, that furnace pipe, that couch, that crack in the wall. Tell me to live for it, and I will," she cried.
It was now me that her strengthless hands laid hold of. She closed her eyes, wept.
"It doesn't have to be love," she whispered. "Just tell me what it should be."
"Razy," I said gently.
"Tell me," she said.
And strength came into her hands, did tender violence to my clothes. "I'm an old man," I said helplessly. It was a coward's lie. I am not an old man.
"All right, old man. Tell me what to live for," she said. "Tell me what you live for, so I can live for it too. Here or 10,000 kilometers from here. Tell me why you want to go on being alive, so I can go on wanting to be alive too."
And then the raiders broke in. The forces of law and order plunged in through every door, waving guns, blowing whistles, shining dazzling lights where there was plenty of light already. There was a small army of them, and they exclaimed all over the melodramatically evil goodies in the cellar. They exclaimed like children around a Christmas tree. A dozen of them, all young, apple-cheeked and virtuous, surrounded Razy, Kraft Potapov, and me, took my Luger away from me, turned us into rag dolls as they ransacked us for other weapons. More raiders came down the stairs, prodding the Reverend Dr. Lionel J.D. Jones, the Black Fuhrer, and Father Keeley before them. Dr. Jones stopped halfway down the stairs, confronted his tormentors.
"All I've done,"
he said majestically, is do what you people should be doing.
What should we be doing?
Said a G-man. He was obviously in command of the raid.
Protecting the Republic, said Jones. Why bother us? Everything we do is to make the country stronger. Join with us, and let's go after the people who are trying to make it weaker.
Who's that? Said the G-man.
I have to tell you, said Jones. Haven't you even found that out in the course of your work? The Jews, the Catholics, the Negroes, the Orientals, the Unitarians, the foreign-born, who don't have any understanding of democracy, who play right into the hands of the socialists, the communists, the anarchists, the Antichrist, and the Jews.
For your information, said the G-man in cool triumph, I am a Jew.
That proves what I've been saying, said Jones.
How's that? Said the G-man.
The Jews have infiltrated everything, said Jones, smiling the smile of a logician who could never be topped.
You talk about the Catholics and the Negroes, said the G-man, and yet here your two best friends are a Catholic and a Negro.
What's so mysterious about that? Said Jones.
Don't you hate them? Said the G-man.
Certainly not, said Jones. We all believe the same basic thing.
What's that? Said the G-man.
This once proud country of ours is falling into the hands of the wrong people, said Jones.
He nodded, and so did Father Keeley and the Black Fuhrer.
And before it gets back on the right track, said Jones, some heads are going to roll.
I have never seen a more sublime demonstration of the totalitarian mind. A mind which might be likened unto a system of gears, whose teeth have been filed off at random. Such a snaggle-toothed thought machine, driven by a standard or even a substandard libido, whirls with the jerky, noisy, gaudy pointlessness of a cuckoo clock in hell. The boss G-man concluded wrongly that there were no teeth on the gears in the mind of Jones.
You're completely crazy, he said.
Jones wasn't completely crazy. The dismaying thing about the classic totalitarian mind is that any given gear, though mutilated, will have at its circumference unbroken sequences of teeth that are immaculately maintained, that are exquisitely machined. Hence the cuckoo clock in hell, keeping perfect time for 8 minutes and 33 seconds, jumping ahead 14 minutes, keeping perfect time for 6 seconds, jumping ahead 2 seconds, keeping perfect time for 2 hours and 1 second, then jumping ahead a year. The missing teeth, of course, are simple, obvious truths. Truths available and comprehensible even to 10-year-olds in most cases. The willful filing off of gear teeth. The willful doing without certain obvious pieces of information. That was how a household as contradictory as one composed of Jones, Father Keeley, Vize-Bundesführer Kraptauer, and the Black Führer could exist in relative harmony. That was how my father-in-law could contain in one mind an indifference towards slave women and love for a blue vase. That was how Rudolf Höss, commandant of Auschwitz, could alternate over the loudspeakers of Auschwitz great music and calls for corpse carriers. That was how Nazi Germany could sense no important differences between civilization and hydrophobia. That is the closest I can come to explaining the legions, the nations of lunatics I've seen in my time. And for me to attempt such a mechanical explanation is perhaps a reflection of the father whose son I was. M. When I pause to think about it, which is rarely, I am, after all, the son of an engineer. Since there is no one else to praise me, I will praise myself. We'll say that I have never tampered with a single tooth in my thought machine, such as it is. There are teeth missing, God knows. Some I was born without, teeth that will never grow. And other teeth have been stripped, by the clutchless shifts of history. But never have I willfully destroyed a tooth on a gear of my thinking machine. Never have I said to myself, "This fact I can do without." Howard W. Campbell, Jr. praises himself. There's life in the old boy yet. And where there's life, there is life. Chapter 39. Raisi Knott bows out.
"My only regret,"
Dr. Jones said to the boss G-man there on the cellar stairs,
"is that I have but one life to give to my country." "We'll see if we can't dig up some other regrets for you, too," said the boss.
Now the Iron Guard of the White Sons of the American Constitution crowded in from the furnace room. Some of the guardsmen were hysterical. The paranoia their parents had been inculcating for years had suddenly paid off.
Here was persecution.
One youth clutched the staff on an American flag. He waved it back and forth, banging the eagle on the tip of the staff against overhead pipes.
"This is your country's flag," he cried. "We already know that," said the boss G-man. "Take it away from him." "This day will go down in history," said Jones.
"Every day goes down in history," said the boss. "All right," he said. "Where's the man who calls himself George Kraft?"
Kraft raised his hand. He did it almost cheerfully.
"Is that your country's flag, too?"
said the boss wryly.
"I'd have to look at it more closely," said Kraft.
"How does it feel to have such a long and distinguished career come to an end?"
the boss asked Kraft.
"All careers do end," said Kraft. "That's something I've known for a long time."
"Maybe they'll make a movie of your life," said the boss.
Kraft smiled.
"Maybe," he said. "I would want a lot of money for the rights."
"There's only one actor who could really play the part, though," said the boss. "He might be hard to get."
"Oh," said Kraft. "Who is that?"
"Charlie Chaplin," said the boss. "Who else could play a spy who was steadily drunk from 1941 until 1948? Who else could play a Russian spy who built an apparatus composed almost entirely of American agents?"
Kraft's urbanity dropped away, revealing him as a pale and puckered old man.
"That's not true," he said.
"Ask your superiors if you don't believe me," said the boss.
"They know," said Kraft.
"They finally caught on," said the boss. "You were on your way back home to a bullet in the back of your neck."
"Why did you save me?" said Kraft.
"Call it sentimentality," said the boss.
Kraft thought his situation over, and schizophrenia rescued him neatly.
"None of this really concerns me,"
he said, and his urbanity returned.
"Why not?" said the boss.
"Because I'm a painter," said Kraft. "That's the main thing I am."
"Be sure to bring your paint box to prison," said the boss.
He switched his attention to Raisi.
"You, of course, are Raisi Knott," he said.
"Yes," she said.
"Have you enjoyed your little stay in our country?" said the boss.
"What am I supposed to say?" said Raisi.
"Anything you like," said the boss. "If you have any complaints, I'll pass them on to the proper authorities. We're trying to increase the tourist trade from Europe, you know."
"You say very funny things," she said unsmilingly. "I am sorry I can't say funny things back. This is not a funny time for me."
"I'm sorry to hear that," said the boss lightly.
"You aren't sorry," said Raisi. "I am the only person who is sorry. I am sorry. I have nothing to live for," said Raisi. "All I have is love for one man. But that man does not love me. He is so used up that he can't love any more. There is nothing left of him but curiosity and a pair of eyes. I can't say anything funny, said Raisi. But I can show you something interesting. Raisi seemed to dab her lip with a finger. What she really did was put a little capsule of cyanide in her mouth. I will show you a woman who dies for love, she said. Right then and there, Raisi Note pitched into my arms. Stone dead.
Chapter 40. Freedom Again. I was arrested, along with everyone else in the house. I was released within an hour, thanks, I suppose, to the intercession of my blue fairy godmother. The place where I was held so briefly was an unmarked office in the Empire State Building. An agent took me down on an elevator and out onto the sidewalk, restoring me to the mainstream of life. I took perhaps 50 steps down the sidewalk, and then I stopped. I froze. It was not guilt that froze me. I had taught myself never to feel guilt. It was not a ghastly sense of loss that froze me. I had taught myself to covet nothing. It was not a loathing of death that froze me. I had taught myself to think of death as a friend. It was not heartbroken rage against injustice that froze me. I had taught myself that a human being might as well look for diamond tiaras in the gutter as for rewards and punishments that were fair. It was not the thought that I was so unloved that froze me. I had taught myself to do without love. It was not the thought that God was cruel that froze me. I had taught myself never to expect anything from Him. What froze me was the fact that I had absolutely no reason to move in any direction. What had made me move through so many dead and pointless years was curiosity. Now even that had flickered out. How long I stood frozen there, I cannot say. If I was ever going to move again, someone else was going to have to furnish the reason for moving. Somebody did. A policeman watched me for a while, and then he came over to me, and he said, "You all right?" "Yes," I said. "You've been standing here a long time," he said. "I know," I said. "You waiting for somebody?" he said. "No," I said. "Better move on, don't you think?" he said. "Yes, sir," I said. And I moved on.
Chapter 41. Chemicals.
From the Empire State Building, I walked downtown. I walked all the way to my old home in Greenwich Village, to Raisi and my and Kraft's old home. I smoked cigarettes all the way, began to think of myself as a lightning bug. I encountered many fellow lightning bugs. Sometimes I gave the cheery red signal first, sometimes they. And I left the seashell roar and the aurora borealis of the city's heart farther and farther behind me. The hour was late. I began to catch signals of fellow lightning bugs trapped in upper stories. Somewhere a siren, a tax-supported mourner, wailed. When I got at last to my building, my home, all windows were dark save one on the second floor. One window in the apartment of young Dr. Abraham Epstein. He too was a lightning bug. He glowed. I glowed back. Somewhere a motorcycle started up. Sounded like a string of firecrackers. A black cat crossed between me and the door of the building. "Ralph?" it said. The entrance hall of the building was dark, too. The ceiling light did not respond to the switch. I struck a match. Saw that the mailboxes had all been broken into.
In the wavering light of the match, and the formless surroundings, the bent and gaping doors of the mailboxes might have been the doors of cells in a jail in a burning city somewhere. My match attracted a patrolman. He was young and lonesome.
"What are you doing here?" he said.
"I live here," I said. "This is my home."
"Any identification?"
he said. So I gave him some identification, told him the attic was mine.
"You're the reason for all this trouble," he said.
He wasn't scolding me. He was simply interested.
"If you say so," I said. "I'm surprised you came back," he said.
"I'll go away again," I said.
"I can't order you to go away," he said. "I'm just surprised you came back."
"It's all right for me to go upstairs," I said.
"It's your home," he said. "Nobody can keep you out of it."
"Thank you," I said.
"Don't thank me," he said. "It's a free country, and everybody gets protected exactly alike."
He said this pleasantly. He was giving me a lesson in civics.
"That's certainly the way to run a country," I said. "I don't know if you're kidding me or not," he said. "But that's right."
"I'm not kidding you," I said. "I swear I'm not." This simple oath of allegiance satisfied him.
"My father was killed on Iwo Jima," he said.
"I'm sorry," I said.
"I guess there were good people killed on both sides," he said.
"I think that's true," I said.
"You think there'll be another one?" he said.
"Another what?" I said.
"Another war," he said.
"Yes," I said.
"Me too," he said. "Isn't that hell?"
"You chose the right word," I said.
"What can any one person do?" he said.
"Each person does a little something," I said. "And there you are." He sighed heavily.
"It all adds up," he said. "People don't realize."
He shook his head.
"What should people do?"
"Obey the laws," I said.
"They don't even want to do that, half of them," he said. "The things I see, the things people say to me. Sometimes I get very discouraged."
"Everybody does that, from time to time," I said.
"I guess it's partly chemistry," he said.
"What is?" I said.
"Getting down in the dumps," he said. "Isn't that what they're finding out? That a lot of that's chemicals?"
"I don't know," I said.
"That's what I read," he said. "That's one of the things they're finding out."
"Very interesting," I said.
"They can give a man certain chemicals, and he goes crazy," he said. "That's one of the things they're working with. Maybe it's all chemicals."
"Very possible," I said.
"Maybe it's different chemicals that different countries eat that makes people act in different ways at different times," he said.
"I'd never thought of that before," I said.
"Why else would people change so much?" he said. "My brother was over in Japan, and he said the Japanese were the nicest people he ever met. And it was the Japanese who killed our father. Think about that for a minute."
"All right," I said.
"It has to be chemicals, doesn't it?" he said.
"I see what you mean," I said.
"Sure," he said. "You think about it some more."
"All right," I said.
"I think about chemicals all the time," he said. "Sometimes I think I should go back to school and find out all the things they found out so far about chemicals."
"I think you should," I said.
"Maybe, when they find out more about chemicals," he said, "there won't have to be policemen or wars or crazy houses or divorces or drunks or juvenile delinquents or women gone bad or anything anymore."
"That would sure be nice," I said.
"It's possible," he said.
"I believe you," I said.
"The way they're going, everything's possible now. If they just work at it, get the money and get the smartest people and get to work. Have a crash program," he said.
"I'm for it," I said.
Look how some women go half off their nut once a month, he said. Certain chemicals get loose, and the women can't help but act that way. Sometimes a certain chemical will get loose after a woman's had a baby, and she'll kill the baby. That happened 4 doors down from here just last week.
How awful, I said. I hadn't heard.
Most unnatural thing a woman can do is kill her own baby. But she did it, he said. Certain chemicals in the blood made her do it, even though she knew better, didn't want to do it at all.
I said.
You wonder what's wrong with the world? He said. Well, there's an important clue. Right there.
Chapter 42. No dove, no covenant. I went upstairs to my ratty attic, went up the oak and plaster snail of the stairwell. While the column of air enclosed by the stairs had carried in the past a melancholy freight of coal dust and cooking smells and the sweat of plumbing, that air was cold and sharp now. Every window in my attic had been broken. All warm gases had been whisked up the stairwell and out my windows, as though up a whistling flue. The air was clean. The feeling of a stale old building suddenly laid open, an infected atmosphere lanced, made clean, was familiar to me. I had felt it often enough in Berlin. Helga and I were bombed out twice. Both times there was a staircase left to climb. One time, we climbed the stairs to a roofless and windowless home, a home otherwise magically undisturbed. Another time, we climbed the stairs to cold, thin air, 2 floors below where home had been. Both moments, at those splintered stairheads under the open sky, were exquisite. The exquisiteness went on for only a short time, naturally, for like any human family, we loved our nests and needed them. But for a minute or two, anyway, Helga and I felt like Noah and his wife on Mount Ararat. There is no better feeling than that. And then the air raid sirens blew again, and we realized that we were ordinary people, without dove or covenant, and that the flood, far from being over, had scarcely begun. I remember one time when Helga and I went from the head of a splintered staircase in the sky down into a shelter deep in the ground, and the big bombs walked all around above. And they walked, and they walked, and they walked. And it seemed that they never would go away. And the shelter was long and narrow, like a railroad car, and it was full. And there was a man, a woman, and their 3 children on the bench facing Helga and me. And the woman started speaking to the ceiling, the bombs, the airplanes, the sky, and to God Almighty above all that. She started softly, but she wasn't talking to anybody in the shelter itself. All right, she said. Here we are. We're right down here. We hear you up there. We hear how angry you are. The loudness of her voice jumped sharply. Dear God, how angry you are, she cried. Her husband, a haggard civilian with a patch over one eye, with the recognition button of the Nazi Teachers Union on his lapel, spoke to her warningly. She did not hear him. What is it you want us to do? She said to the ceiling and all that lay above. Whatever it is you want us to do, she said, tell us and we'll do it. A bomb crashed down close by, shook loose from the ceiling a snowfall of calcimine, brought the woman to her feet shrieking and her husband with her. We surrender, we give up, she yelled, and great relief and happiness spread over her face. You can stop now, she yelled. She laughed. We quit, it's over. She turned to tell the good news to her children. Her husband knocked her cold. That one-eyed teacher set her down on the bench, propped her against the wall. And then he went to the highest-ranking person present, a vice admiral,
as it happened. She's a woman, hysterical. They get hysterical. She doesn't mean it. She has the golden order of parenthood, he said to the Vice Admiral. The Vice Admiral wasn't baffled or annoyed. He didn't feel miscast. With fine dignity, he gave the man absolution. It's all right, he said. It's understandable. Don't worry. The teacher marveled at a system that could forgive weakness. Heil Hitler, he said, bowing as he backed away. Heil Hitler, said the Vice Admiral. The teacher now began to revive his wife. He had good news for her, that she was forgiven, that everyone understood. And all the time, the bombs walked and walked overhead. And the schoolteacher's three children did not bat an eye. Nor, I thought, would they ever. Nor, I thought, would I ever again.
Chapter 43. St. George and the Dragon. The door of my ratty attic had been torn off its hinges, had disappeared entirely. In its place, the janitor had tacked a pup tent of mine, and over the pup tent a zigzag of boards. He had written on the zigzag boards, in gold radiator paint that reflected the light of my match, "Nobody and nothing inside." Be that as it may, somebody had since ripped a bottom corner of the canvas free of its tacks, giving my ratty attic a small, triangular flap door, like a teepee. I crawled in. The light switch in my attic did not respond either. What light there was came through the few unbroken window panes. The broken panes had been replaced with wads of paper, rags, clothes, and bedding. Night winds whistled around these wads. What light there was blue. I looked out through the back windows by the stove, looked down into the foreshortened enchantment of the little private park below, the little Eden formed of joined backyards. No one was playing in it now. There was no one in it to cry, as I should have liked someone to cry. Olly olly oxen free. There was a stir, a rustle in the shadows of my attic. I imagined it to be the rustle of a rat. I was wrong. It was the rustle of Bernard B. O'Hare, the man who had captured me so long ago. It was the stir of my own personal fury, the man who perceived his noblest aspect in his loathing and hounding of me. I do not mean to slander him by associating the sound he made with the sound of a rat. I do not think of O'Hare as a rat, though his actions with regard to me had the same nagging irrelevance as the rat's scrabbling passions in my attic walls. I didn't really know O'Hare, and I didn't want to know him. The fact of his having put me under arrest in Germany was a fact of submicroscopic interest to me. He wasn't my nemesis. My game was up long before O'Hare took me into custody. To me, O'Hare was simply one more gatherer of wind-blown trash in the tracks of war. O'Hare had a far more exciting view of what we were to each other, when drunk at any rate. He thought of himself as St. George, and of me as the Dragon. When I first saw him in the shadows of my attic, he was seated on a galvanized bucket turned upside down. He was in the uniform of the American Legion. He had a quart of whiskey with him. He had apparently been waiting for me a long time, drinking and smoking the while. He was drunk, but he had kept his uniform neat. His tie was straight. His cap was on and set at the proper angle. The uniform was important to him, was supposed to be important to me, too. "Know who I am?" he said. "Yes," I said.
I'm not as young as I once was, he said. Haven't changed much, have I?
No, I said.
I've described him earlier in this account as having looked like a lean young wolf. When I saw him in my attic, he looked unhealthy, pale and stringy and hot-eyed. He had become less wolf than coyote, I thought. His post-war years had not been years of merry blooming.
Expecting me? He said.
You told me I could, I said. I had to be polite and careful with him. I supposed correctly that he meant to hurt me. The fact that he was in a very neat uniform, and that he was smaller and much lighter than me, suggested that he had a weapon on him somewhere, most likely a gun. He now got off the bucket, showing me, in his ramshackle rising, how drunk he was. He knocked the bucket over in the process. He grinned.
Ever have nightmares about me, Campbell? He said.
Often, I said. It was a lie, of course.
Surprised I didn't bring anybody with me? He said.
Yes, I said.
Plenty of people wanted to come along, he said. There was a whole bunch wanted to come down with me from Boston. And after I got to New York this afternoon, I went into a bar and got talking to some strangers. And they asked if they could come along, too.
I said.
And you know what I said to them?
He asked me. Nope, I said.
I said to them, sorry, boys, but this is a party just for Campbell and me. That's the way it's got to be, just the two of us, face to face, he said.
I said.
This thing's been a building over the years, I told him, said O'Hare. It's in the stars, I told him. In the stars that Howard Campbell and me meet again after all these years. Don't you feel that way? He asked me.
What way? I said.
It's in the stars, he said. We had to meet like this. Right here in this very room. And neither one of us could have avoided it if we'd tried.
Possibly, I said.
Just when you think there isn't any point to life, he said. Then all of a sudden you realize you are being aimed right straight at something.
I know what you mean, I said. He swayed, steadied himself.
You know what I do for a living? He said.
No, I said.
Dispatcher for frozen custard trucks, he said.
Pardon me, I said.
Fleet of trucks goes around to factories, beaches, ball games, anywhere there's people.
O'Hare seemed to forget all about me for a few seconds, to reflect murkily on the mission of the trucks he dispatched.
Custard machines right there on the truck, he murmured. Two flavors is all, chocolate and vanilla.
His mood was exactly what poor Raisie's mood had been when she told me about the ghastly pointlessness of her job at a cigarette-making machine in Dresden.
When the war ended, O'Hare said to me, I expected to be a lot more in 15 years than a dispatcher of frozen custard trucks.
I guess we've all had disappointments, I said. He didn't respond to this feeble try at brotherhood. His concern was for himself alone.
I was going to be a doctor. I was going to be a lawyer. A writer, an architect, an engineer, a newspaper reporter, he said. There wasn't anything I couldn't be, he said. And then I got married, he said. And the wife started having kids right away. And I opened a damn diaper service with a buddy. And the buddy ran off with the money, and the wife kept having kids. After the diaper service, it was Venetian blinds. And after the Venetian blind business went bust, it was frozen custard. And all the time, the wife was having more kids. And the damn car breaking down. And bill collectors coming around. And termites boiling out of the baseboards every spring and fall.
Sorry, I said.
And I asked myself, said O'Hare, what does it mean? Where do I fit in? What's the point of any of it?
Good questions, I said softly. And I put myself close to a pair of heavy fire tongs.
and then somebody sent me a copy of that newspaper with the story of how you were still alive, said O'Hare.
And he relived for me the cruel excitement the story had given him.
And then it hit me, he said, why I was alive, and what the main thing was I was supposed to do.
He took a step toward me, his eyes wide.
Here I come, Campbell, out of the past.
How do you do, I said.
You know what you are to me, Campbell,
he said. No, I said.
You're pure evil, he said. You're absolutely pure evil.
Thank you, I said.
You're right. It is a kind of compliment, he said. Usually a bad man's got some good in him. Almost as much good as evil. But you, he said, you're the pure thing. For all the good there is in you, you might as well be the devil.
Maybe I am the devil, I said.
Don't think I haven't thought of that, he said.
What do you plan to do to me? I asked him.
Take you apart, he said,
rocking back and forth on the balls of his feet, rolling his shoulders, loosening them.
When I heard you were alive, I knew it was something I had to do. There wasn't any way out, he said. It had to end like this.
I don't see why, I said.
Then by God, I'll show you why, he said. I'll show you, by God. I was born just to take you apart right here and now.
He called me a yellow belly. He called me a Nazi. And then he called me the most offensive compound word in the English language. So I broke his good right arm with the fire tongs. That is the only violent act I ever committed in what has now been a long, long life. I met O'Hare in single combat, and I beat him. Beating him was easy. O'Hare was so drugged by booze and fantasies of good triumphing over evil that he hadn't expected me to defend myself. When he realized that he'd been hit, that the dragon meant to give St. George a real tussle, he looked very surprised.
So that's the way you want to play, he said.
And then the agony of a multiple fracture suffused his nervous system, and tears came to his eyes. Get out, I said. Or do you want me to break your other arm and your head, too? I put the tip of the fire tongs by his right temple, and I said, and I'll take the gun or the knife or whatever it is before you go. He shook his head. The pain was so awful that he could not speak. You're not armed, I said. He shook his head again.
Fair fight, he said thickly. Fair.
I patted his pockets, and there weren't any weapons on him. St. George had expected to take the dragon apart with his bare hands. You poor, silly, drunk, one-armed son of a bitch, I said. I tore down the tent in my doorway, kicked out the zigzag of boards. I shoved O'Hare through the opening onto the landing outside. The railing stopped O'Hare, and he gazed down the stairwell, down a beckoning helix to the patch of sure death below. I'm not your destiny, or the devil either, I said. Look at you. Came to kill evil with your bare hands, and now away you go with no more glory than a man sideswiped by a Greyhound bus. And that's all the glory you deserve, I said. That's all that any man at war with pure evil deserves. There are plenty of good reasons for fighting, I said, but no good reason ever to hate without reservation. To imagine that God Almighty himself hates with you too. Where's evil? It's that large part of every man that wants to hate without limit, that wants to hate with God on its side. It's that part of every man that finds all kinds of ugliness so attractive. It's that part of an imbecile, I said, that punishes and vilifies and makes war gladly. Whether it was my words or humiliation or booze or surgical shock that made O'Hare throw up, I do not know. Throw up he did.
He flashed the hash down the stairwell from four stories up. "Clean it up," I said. He faced me, his eyes still filled with undiluted hatred.
"I'll get you yet, brother," he said.
"That may be," I said, "but it won't change your destiny of bankruptcies, frozen custard, too many children, termites, and no cash. If you want to be a soldier in the legions of God so much," I told him, "try the Salvation Army." And O'Hare went away.
Chapter 44. Kambu. It is a common experience among jailbirds to wake up and wonder why they are in jail. A theory I propose to myself on such occasions is that I am in jail because I could not bring myself to walk through or leap over another man's vomit. I am referring to the vomit of Bernard B. O'Hare on the foyer floor at the foot of the stairwell. I left my attic shortly after O'Hare did. There was nothing to keep me there. I took a memento with me, quite by accident. As I left my attic, I kicked something over the threshold and onto the landing. I picked it up. It was a pawn from the chess set I had carved from a broom handle. I put it in my pocket. I have it still. As I slipped it into my pocket, the stench of the public nuisance O'Hare had created reached me. As I descended the stairs, the stench grew worse. When I reached the landing outside the door of young Dr. Abraham Epstein, a man who had spent his childhood in Auschwitz, the stench stopped me. The next thing I knew, I was knocking on Dr. Epstein's door. The doctor came to the door in bathrobe and pajamas. His feet were bare. He was startled to see me. "Yes," he said. "Could I come in?" I said. "This is a medical matter?" he said. There was a chain across the door. "No," I said. "Personal. Political." "It can't wait," he said. "I'd rather it didn't," I said. "Give me an idea of what this is all about," he said. "I want to go to Israel to stand trial," I said. "You what?" he said. "I want to be tried for my crimes against humanity," I said. "I'm willing to go." "Why come to me?" he said. "I thought you might know somebody. Somebody who'd like to be notified," I said. "I'm not a representative of Israel," he said. "I'm an American. Tomorrow you can find all the Israelis you want." "I'd like to surrender to an Auschwitzer," I said. This made him mad. "Then find one who thinks about Auschwitz all the time," he said. "There are plenty who think about nothing else. I never think about it." And he slammed the door. I froze again, frustrated in the one purpose I'd been able to imagine for myself. What Epstein had said about Israelis being available in the morning was surely true. But there was still the night to get through, and I could not move. Epstein talked to his mother inside. They talked in German. I heard only bits of what they said. Epstein was telling his mother what had just happened. One thing I did hear that impressed me was their use of my last name. The sound of my last name. "Kambu," they said again and again. That was Campbell to them. That was the undiluted evil in me. The evil that had had its effect on millions. The disgusting creature good people wanted dead and underground. Kambu. Epstein's mother got so excited about Kambu and what he was up to now that she came to the door. I'm sure that she did not expect to see Kambu himself. She wanted only to loathe and wonder at the air he had lately displaced. She opened the door, her son right behind her, telling her not to do it. She almost fainted at the sight of Kambu himself, Kambu in a state of catalepsis. Epstein pushed her aside, came out as though to attack me. "What do you think you're doing?" he said. "Get the hell away from here." When I did not move, did not reply, did not even blink, did not even seem to breathe, he began to understand that I was a medical problem after all. "Oh, for Christ's sake," he lamented.
like a friendly robot. I let him lead me inside. He took me back into the kitchen area of his flat, sat me down at a white table there. "Can you hear me?" he said.
"Yes," I said.
"Do you know who I am, where you are?" he said. "Yes," I said. "Have you ever been like this before?" he said.
"No," I said.
"You need a psychiatrist," he said. "I'm no psychiatrist."
"I told you what I need," I said.
"Call up somebody, not a psychiatrist. Call up somebody who wants to give me a trial." Epstein and his mother, a very old woman, argued back and forth about what to do with me. His mother understood my illness immediately, that it was my world rather than myself that was diseased.
"This is not the first time you've seen eyes like that," she said to her son in German. "Not the first man you've seen who could not move unless someone told him where to move, who longed for someone to tell him what to do next, who would do anything anyone told him to do next. You saw thousands of them at Auschwitz."
"I don't remember," said Epstein tautly.
"All right," said his mother. "Then let me remember. I can remember. Every minute I can remember." "And as one who remembers," said his mother, "let me say that what he asks for, he should have. Call someone."
"Who will I call?" said Epstein. "I'm not a Zionist. I'm an anti-Zionist. I'm not even that. I never think about it. I'm a physician. I don't know anybody who's still looking for revenge. I have nothing but contempt for them. Go away. You've come to the wrong place."
"Call somebody," said his mother.
"You still want revenge?" he asked her.
"Yes," she said.
He put his face close to mine. "And you really want to be punished," he said.
"I want to be tried," I said.
"It's all play acting," he said, exasperated with both of us. "It proves nothing."
"Call somebody," said his mother.
Epstein threw up his hands.
All right, I will call Sam. I will tell him he can be a great Zionist hero. He always wanted to be a great Zionist hero."
What Sam's last name was, I never found out. Dr. Epstein called him from the front room of the flat while I remained in the kitchen with Epstein's old mother. His mother sat down at the table, faced me, rested her arms on the table, studied my face with melancholy curiosity and satisfaction.
"They took all the light bulbs," she said in German.
"What?" I said.
"The people who broke into your apartment. They took all the light bulbs from the stairway," she said.
I said.
"In Germany, too," she said.
"Pardon me," I said.
"That was one of the things. When the SS or the Gestapo came and took somebody away," she said.
"I don't understand," I said.
"Other people would come into the building, wanting to do something patriotic," she said. "And that was one of the things they always did. Somebody always took the light bulbs."
She shook her head.
"Such a strange thing for somebody always to do."
Dr. Epstein came back into the kitchen, dusting his hands.
"All right," he said. "Three heroes will be here shortly. A tailor, a watchmaker, and pediatrician. All delighted to play the part of Israeli parachutists."
"Thank you," I said. The three came for me in about 20 minutes. They had no weapons, and no status as agents of Israel or as agents of anything but themselves. The only status they had was what my infamy and my anxiousness to surrender to somebody, to almost anybody, gave them. What my arrest amounted to was a bed for the rest of the night, in the tailor's apartment, as it happened. The next morning, the three surrendered me, with my permission, to Israeli officials. When the three came for me at Dr. Epstein's apartment, they banged on the front door loudly. The instant they did that, I felt enormously relieved. I felt happy.
"You're all right now?" said Epstein, before he let them in.
"Yes. Thank you, doctor," I said.
You still want to go?
He said.
Yes, I said.
He has to go, said his mother.
And then she leaned closer to me, across the kitchen table. She crooned something in German, made it sound like a fragment of a ditty remembered from a happy childhood. What she crooned was this, a command she had heard over the loudspeakers of Auschwitz, had heard many times a day for years.
Leichenträger zu wache,
she crooned. A beautiful language, isn't it?
Translation?
Corpse carriers to the guardhouse. That's what that old woman crooned to me. Chapter 45. The Tortoise and the Hare. So here I am in Israel, of my own free will, though my cell is locked and my guards have guns. My story is told, and none too soon, for tomorrow my trial begins. The hare of history once more overtakes the tortoise of art. There will be no more time for writing. Adventuring, I must go again. There are many to testify against me, none to testify for me. The prosecution intends to begin, I'm told, by playing recordings of the worst of my broadcasts, so the most pitiless witness against me will be myself. Bernard B. O'Hare is in town at his own expense, annoying the prosecution with the feverish irrelevance of all he has to say. So too is Heinz Schildknecht, my erstwhile best friend and doubles partner, the man whose motorcycle I stole. My lawyer says that Heinz is full of venom for me, and that Heinz, surprisingly, will make a credible witness. Whence this respectability for Heinz, who, after all, worked at a desk next to mine in the Ministry of Propaganda and Popular Enlightenment? Surprise! Heinz is a Jew, a member of the anti-Nazi underground during the war, an Israeli agent after the war and up to the present time. And he can prove it. Good for Heinz. Dr. Lionel J.D. Jones, DDS, DD, and Iona Potapov, alias George Kraft, can't come to my trial, both serving in a United States federal prison as they are. They have both sent affidavits, however. The affidavits of Dr. Jones and Kraft Potapov aren't much help, to say the least. Dr. Jones declares under oath that I am a saint and a martyr in the holy Nazi cause. He says, too, that I have the most perfect set of Aryan teeth he's ever seen outside of photographs of Hitler. Kraft Potapov declares under oath that Russian intelligence was never able to turn up any proof that I had been an American agent. He offers the opinion that I was an ardent Nazi, but that I shouldn't be held responsible for my acts, since I was a political idiot, an artist who could not distinguish between reality and dreams. The three men who took me into custody in Dr. Epstein's apartment are on hand for the trial. The tailor, the watchmaker, and the pediatrician, on an even more bootless junket than Bernard B. O'Hare's. Howard W. Campbell, Jr., this is your life. My Israeli lawyer, Mr. Alvin Dobrowitz, has had all my New York mail forwarded here, hoping unreasonably to find in that mail some proof of my innocence. Hi-ho. Three letters came today. I shall open them now, reporting their contents one by one. Hope springs eternal, they say, in the human breast. It springs eternal, at any rate, in the breast of Dobrowitz, which is, I suppose, why he cost so much. All that I need to be a free man, says Dobrowitz, is the barest proof that there was such a person as Frank Wirtanen, and that Wirtanen made me an American spy. Well now, about the letters for today. The first starts off warmly enough. Dear friend, it calls me, in spite of all the evil things I am said to have done. It assumes that I am a teacher. I explained in an earlier chapter, I believe, how my name happened to find its way onto a list of supposed educators, how I became recipient of mail promoting materials useful to those in charge of training the young. The letter at hand is from Creative Playthings, Inc. Dear friend, creative plaything says to me, here in a Jerusalem jail, would you like to foster a creative environment for your students in their own homes? What happens to them after they leave school certainly is important. You may have a child under your direction an average of 25 waking hours per week, but the parent guides him for 45 hours. What a parent does with these hours can complicate or facilitate your program. We believe the kind of toys Creative Plaything sponsors will genuinely stimulate, in the home, the creative environment you, as an early childhood leader, are trying to foster. How can Creative Playthings toys in the home do this? Such toys can provide for the physical needs of growing children. Such toys help a child discover and experiment with life in the home and community. Such toys promote opportunities for individual expression, which may be lacking in the group life of the school. Such toys help the child work off aggressions. To which I reply, dear friends, as one who has experienced extensively with life in the home and community, using real people in true-to-life situations, I doubt that any playthings could prepare a child for 1/1,000,000th of what is going to hit him in the teeth, ready or not. My own feeling is that a child should start experimenting with real people and real communities from the moment of birth, if possible. If, for some reason, these materials are not available, then playthings must be used. But not bland, pleasing, smooth, easily manipulated playthings like those in your brochure, friends. Let there be nothing harmonious about our children's playthings, lest they grow up expecting peace and order and be eaten alive. As for children's working off aggressions, I'm against it. They are going to need all the aggressions they can contain for ultimate release in the adult world. Name one great man in history who did not go boiling and bubbling through childhood with a lash-down safety valve. Let me tell you that the children in my charge for an average of 25 hours a week are not likely to lose their keen edge during the 45 hours they spend with their parents. They aren't moving hand-carved animals on and off a Noah's Ark, believe me. They are spying on real grown-ups all the time, learning what they fight about, what they're greedy for, how they satisfy their greed, why and how they lie, what makes them go crazy, the different ways they go crazy, and so on. I cannot predict the fields in which these children of mine will succeed, but I guarantee success for them without exception anywhere in the civilized world. Yours for realistic pedagogy, Howard W. Campbell, Jr. The second letter? It too addresses Howard W. Campbell, Jr. as Dear Friend, proving that at least two out of three letter writers today aren't sore at Howard W. Campbell, Jr. at all. The letter is from a stockbroker in Toronto, Canada. It is addressed to the capitalistic aspect of me. It wants me to buy stock in a tungsten mine in Manitoba. Before I did that, I would have to know more about the company. I would have to know, in particular, whether it had a capable and reputable management. I wasn't born yesterday. The third letter? It is addressed direct to me in prison here. And it's a curious letter indeed. Let it here be seen whole. Dear Howard, the discipline of a lifetime now collapses like the fabled walls of Jericho. Who is Joshua? And what is the tune his trumpets play? I wish I knew. The music that has worked such havoc against such old walls is not loud. It is faint, diffuse, and peculiar. Could it be the music of my conscience? That I doubt. I have done no wrong to you. I think the music must be an old soldier's itch for just a little treason. And treason this letter is. I here violate direct and explicit orders that were given to me. Were given to me in the best interests of the United States of America. I here give you my true name. And I identify myself as the man you knew as Frank Wirtanen. My name is Harold J. Sparrow. My rank at time of retirement from the United States Army was colonel. My serial number is 0-61134. I exist. I can be seen, heard, and touched almost any day, in or around the only dwelling on Coggins Pond, 6 miles due west of Hinckleyville, Maine. I affirm, and will affirm under oath, that I recruited you as an American agent, and that you, at personal sacrifices that proved total, became one of the most effective agents of the Second World War. If there must be a trial of Howard W. Campbell, Jr., by the forces of self-righteous nationalism, let it be one hell of a contest. Yours truly, Frank. So I am about to be a free man again, to wander where I please. I find the prospect nauseating. I think that tonight is the night I will hang Howard W. Campbell, Jr. for crimes against himself. I know that tonight is the night. They say that a hanging man hears gorgeous music. Too bad that I, like my father, unlike my musical mother, am tone deaf. All the same, I hope that the tune I am about to hear is not Bing Crosby's White Christmas. Goodbye, cruel world. Auf Wiedersehen.
This has been an Audible Modern Classics production. Executive producer, Steve Feldberg. Supervising producer, Mike Charzik. Producer, Gail Hendricks. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 1961 and 1966 by Kurt Vonnegut. Audio recording copyright 2008 by Audible, Inc.